Hello and welcome to Sandy by the Sea, a snapshot of life from the island at the end of England. In this episode, I talk to Dr. Dave Allen about the life and work of the late photographer Harry Hammond, a key figure in capturing the birth and boom of British rock and roll in the late 1950s. Dave talks me through some of the Archive of Wonder currently on loan from the V&A to Portsmouth City Museum, as well as the many quirky local archive pieces from Pompey and South Sea Rock's golden era. So I'm with Dr. Dave Allen, who's a senior lecturer at University of Portsmouth, and is also helping curate and, I suppose, coordinate the Birth of British Rock exhibition. So, Dave, if you can just start by sort of telling us a little bit about the exhibition and in terms of its focus.
Its focus is particularly around the work of one photographer called Harry Hammond and his archive, which stretches across popular entertainment in Britain, sometimes American musicians, but in Britain, from the early 50s through to about the mid 60s, although it really wraps up around 63, 64 time. The story about Harry is that he was one of those old-fashioned professional photographers before the personality photographers like David Bailey came along. He was a sort of a hard-working press photographer who got into showbiz and got bored with it at the point where the Beatles and others became such big celebrities. The story is that he turned up one day and there were 200 photographers there and he said, well, blow this, I can't be bothered with this anymore, and gave up. He took up management for a time after that, but he left this wonderful archive of, I suppose in a way, it's not just the birth of British rock which interests me, because it's also that classic period when a lot of Americans began to tour here for the first time. So you've got Frank Sinatra and Billie Holiday in the show as well.
And Harry Hammond was I suppose he was a kind of society photographer. Is that the right sort of phrase?
Yeah, I suppose it would be, really. I mean, it was just a different world, wasn't it, in those days? You can see there's one lovely shot of him, I think with Al McCogan, where you can see him in the background. He's got a moustache and he looks generally but thoroughly respectable, not at all rock and roll. Although I think he quite liked it because he took up management of one or two acts. But he has that image of the professional people who worked in showbiz in the 50s, you know, who'd probably at some point at least done national service, if not in the war, and, you know, went to work with a suit. And it was a different world, really, and he just was very professional about it. And the V&A inherited this enormous archive of his work, and they've made a selection from it, so it's not by any means the whole thing.
And he himself did a stint in the RAF, I think, when the Second World War came along.
Okay, well, you know more about him than I do.
I think he spent some time hanging out of planes and taking reconnaissance shots and things, which obviously is slightly different from his NME period, I suppose.
But I guess technically it would be important because, of course, it was a more technical thing in those days. These days, with digital photography, you can just bang things off left, right and centre and usually create something out of it, you know, once you've got it on a computer screen. I think he was technically pretty proficient. Yeah, they're good photographs. I like them very much.
And that period, the 50s and the 60s, is often sort of fated, if you like, as being a kind of golden era. And just tell us something about why it was so important, because obviously the transatlantic link, I think, was one of the major...
That was important, and there had been an issue in Britain previously, which was that the Musicians' Union wouldn't do deals with America. So, in fact... I mean, the famous story is the one about when in the 40s, when bebop, it began interesting, the modern jazz players, they all joined dance bands on the great liners just so they could end up in New York and go and hear Charlie Parker, because he couldn't come to England. So we would get recordings from America of the great jazz acts, but we wouldn't necessarily see them. And so that's a crucial thing. There are other crucial elements as well. One is, you know, the end of the war, the end of rationing, the fact that teenagers had a little bit of money so they could begin to spend it on fashion and clothes. The enormous improvements in recording facilities, the development of the long playing record and the 45 single as opposed to the 78, the amplified guitar. There's so many things all came along together. Bang, bang, bang. And then there was a bloke called Elvis who had a bit of an impact as well. Yeah. And that was a sort of stylistic impact, if you like, of the sort of rhythm and blues down home country that became rock and roll. and had a huge impact in this country. So that all those things, bang, 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 together.
Some things I've read have said that the kind of the birth, if you like, of that era was more of a kind of a response to something than a kind of an organic development. What would your take be on that?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, I was very young at the time. I do remember being about... I was born in 1949, so I remember at the age of about 6 or 7, a rainy playtime at school and some kids getting up and singing Rock Around the Clock, and I thought it was the most astonishing thing ever. I guess what you could say... there is this kind of classic idea that it was a response to the rather dull 50s, and we have this image of the 50s as being very grey and so on and so on. I always thought that depended, really. I mean, I grew up in the 50s, and if you're a kid, you know, growing up in a seaside town, it's not that dull. It was, you know, I had great days on the beach, summers, you know, having fun. And I mean, if you look back on it now, you think the pleasures that we got from that were pretty simple, really. You couldn't hear a lot of pop music on the radio. The BBC had a thing called the Light Programme, but if you go through the Radio Times, you see... at most an hour or two a day. There was no Radio 1. There were jukeboxes in cafes, but of course most of us weren't encouraged by our parents to go into cafes because they were dodgy places, you know. these things they weren't ubiquitous as they are today, you know. Nowadays popular music is everywhere. There weren't adverts on the telly with pop music on and so on and so on, and there weren't newspapers with lurid stories on the front pages about pop stars. So there was an innocence about it, and I suppose it went hand in hand with an excitement. And you got it from film stars as well. You got it from Munro and Brando and James Dean and Steve McQueen and so on. So we in Britain, we were captivated by the excitement of America, I suppose. And for a certain generation, at least, it was pretty exciting.
What do you think that the exhibition tells us in photo, what music can't... Like, what do you think the photos capture that isn't on the acetate or on the vinyl?
I think one of the things I like very much about the photographs is the range of pictures. So within a very short period after that, most of the pictures that you get of histories of popular music tend to be much more posed and celebrity focused, because the industry becomes much more posed and celebrity focused. There are off chance photographs here. There are backstage things. There are pictures of Tommy Steele's dressing room without Tommy there. There are pictures of fans on the street or ticket offices where you could go and buy the tickets. And it gives you more of a feel of how, if you like, a professional and celebrity-driven showbiz was developing. But it gives you that feel before it was a highly developed industry. I mean, it's very, very pre-Simon Cowell, if you like. You know, nowadays everything is packaged and organised and remote. And I do think this is an important truth. You have some sense in the Harry Hammond images of ordinary people consuming and making. You know, you have some sense of the stars being ordinary people who just get picked up. And so the local bits that we've put in are saying the same things, really. They're saying that everything was a bit more ordinary, and yet there was this magical other world that it constructed for us at the same time.
Okay, we're taking a look at some of the photos in the exhibition now, and Dave, tell me about this one here.
Well, there's four people for a start. There's Jet Harris, who was the bass guitarist in The Shadows, who were a kind of early favourite for people of my generation who wanted to become musicians. There's Little Richard, who was, for me, the greatest of the rock and rollers. And I saw him in Portsmouth at the Birdcage Club in the mid-60s, and he was fabulous.
He's doing a very crafty wink in this picture.
Yeah, he is. Well, he was a bit of a lad, was Little Richard. Gene Vincent, who... I mean, had a pretty unhappy life in the end, really. Toured with Eddie Cochran and was in the crash that killed Cochran, and suffered injuries, which meant he was on painkillers ever after and got addicted to painkillers. But he did make that wonderful record, Bebopalula, with his band, the Blue Caps, who had that great raw guitar sound. And then there's Sam Cooke, who, along with Ray Charles, is... in some senses considered the inventor of soul music. So you've got that whole range there, you know, British beat, great rock and roll, the sort of rockabilly rock and roll of Vincent, and, you know, the gospel into soul, all of which were wonderful
genres of the time. So that's a lovely shot.
It's a very natural shot as well, isn't it? It's not, as we were saying earlier, there's no sort of posing or kind of, you know.
That's right. They just happened to be in the dressing room, and I guess Harry said, quick, stand over here, and they shuffled, and little Richard has taken his shirt off because he was a pretty hot performer, and I guess he's just come off probably, so he's wrapped a towel around himself, and yeah, that's right. They look relaxed and happy to be together, and I guess you would have to make the comment as well that it's an interracial photograph, which for about 59 or 60 is a significant picture, and of course it's not insignificant that that's in England rather than America.
Harry Hammond's often sort of, again, sort of fated, if you like, in being the sort of first great rock photographer, or certainly British rock photographer. What do you think his influence has been on in terms of, I suppose it's happened over time, but in terms of sort of multimedia, if you like, because it strikes me that he made very good use of the gig and the event, and also, you know, of the NME and of the, you know, the kind of the TV show, which at the time, you know, music TV was quite a rare big event. Nowadays, obviously, as you say, it's kind of a ubiquitous thing.
But yeah, I mean, there's all the VHS and MTV channels now, and one of the wonderful things he did was to chronicle the changes were rapid, you know. I mean, there was a thing called 6.5 Special, which a lot of people remember nostalgically, and we've got some magazines about it as well, and he's got some shots. And it lasted 18 months, and then it was gone, bang, the next thing, and so on. I think his impact is interesting to talk about, because I remember buying the NME at the time, and I remember seeing these photographs, and I remember having no sense that it was Harry Hammond. I didn't know. There was no personality connected with these pictures. They were just the pictures were of personalities. So you got to be excited about Billy Fury or Cliff Richard or The Shadows or whatever it was, but you didn't link the names of photographers until the classic trio, the David Bailey, Terence Donovan, and the other man whose name is completely escaping at the moment. But, you know, suddenly there was, in the swinging mid-60s, the photographers themselves became stars, in the same way, of course, that fashion models became stars, Gene Shrimpton and so on, Twiggy. They had never been stars before. They had just been people modelling. I mean, they were glamorous, but they were just anonymous people modelling clothes. So what he does is, two things, really. He kind of opens that door to that period where everybody's named and everybody's a personality and a star and so on. But he also, I think the great value of him today is to remind us of the importance of the chance shot, the backstage image, the thing that you didn't necessarily expect to see, which often reveals more about those people than when they're under the spotlight on the stage. Yeah.
Do you think perhaps, I think it's probably true, that he helped, I suppose, give music photography and sort of rock photography like credibility as as an industry, but also perhaps helped give some of those acts the credibility they needed up against their kind of, you know, the American heavyweights, if you like?
I think that's massively important and enormously true, because, of course, when rock and roll first hit, 54 a little bit with Bill Haley, the late 55, early 56, when Elvis comes along, Fats Domino, Carl Perkins, it's all American. And in some ways, the thing that competes with it in this country is Lonnie Donegan and Skiffle, but that's massive, but very short-lived. And then, really, we go back to a period where, briefly, in the late 50s, Cliff Richard, Billy Fury, Marty Wilde, they're all British, but they're rather American. And then suddenly, this thing happens where Britain really does take over the world of popular music, and of course the Beatles are at the heart of that, but not exclusively. There's, you know, there's the Animals and the Rolling Stones and the Dave Clark Five, and Dusty Springfield, and so on and so on. And we are as good, if not better than the place that created it, and that was extraordinary. And you can't do that without the whole package, really. You can't do it if it's just the music. I mean, the jukebox and the radio will sustain it if it's just music, but of course television is becoming big. The Beatles are huge because of their Ed Sullivan TV appearance. And so image becomes vital, and the one place in which image is captured and held is in the single photograph. And Hammond has played a massive, massive part in that. So there are those archetypal pictures of Cliff brushing his quiff.
Just going back to Harry Hammond, he sadly passed away last February, I think it was.
I'll tell you a nice little story. His widow and daughter came to the opening. and they really enjoyed it. That was the first, they hadn't seen the show on its other, it had been in Wales before, and so they enjoyed that very much. I think were very pleased about it.
Great.
But he did pass away, yes, last year, yeah.
Now this picture is of Bully Fury in a very shiny suit, it has to be said.
It's a fan.
It had been in Wales before, and so they enjoyed that very much. I think were very pleased about it.
Great.
But he did pass away, yes, last year, yeah.
Now this picture is of Bully Fury in a very shiny suit, it has to be said.
It's a fantastic suit, isn't it? And they've got those lovely, they're like Chelsea boots, but they're Chelsea shoes, which were very briefly fashionable with the elasticated sides. And it's great because it looks posed, but it's just perfectly composed because he's performing live. There's no doubt about that. You know, there's got real guitar leads plugged in there, which is nice. And it's iconic in every sense, really. The guy on the left is called Hines, who was the bass guitarist of the Tornadoes. The Tornadoes had that big hit with Telstar, the instrumental, and Hines went solo after that. Sadly, then went into oblivion, really, and ended his days rather unhappily living in Southampton. I think he was a Southampton man, and he had a rather unhappy end to his life, but he was briefly a blonde superstar, you know, at that period. Joe Meek, who's just been enshrined in the film Telstar, was the man who produced the Hines records. Billy was the great British rock and roller, really. He was the one who took over from Cliff, and he was a better rock and roller than Cliff, really. But the guy on the right is fascinating because he looks kind of sweet and old-fashioned with that big acoustic 12-string there.
Mm-hmm.
And his name is George Bellamy, and I can't tell you the precise name, but his son is the lead figure, lead singer or whatever, in Muse.
Ah, Matt Bellamy.
Okay, yeah, mm-hmm. That's him. So that's Matt's dad, yeah? And he was the guitarist of the Tornadoes back in Billy Fury. But Billy just looks great. Billy was one of the great favourites of my wife. She's still really fond of him. He was very sexy.
There's a hint of eyeliner as well, isn't there?
Oh, sure. There is a hint of eyeliner. And in those days, that was more of a kind of showbiz thing than any sense of a transsexual thing. Although there was around this band, in terms of, well, the history of Joe Meek and the agent promoter, there was always that undercurrent of the homoerotic thing going on in those days. There are lots of stories about that, and I think most of the times these young men were discovered and then spent a lot of their time running away from these guys and resisting their advances. And but it's a great
picture. It's a great picture, and the kind of the darkness behind it contrasting with the figures is great, isn't it? It's really kind of captured the light of that.
Because I suspect that there's an audience back there. There are little dots there, and I think you'll see it elsewhere. I think you can see it in this one here. Just see that hint of audience. It's the same thing. It's the Musical Express. It's the NME Poll Winners concert. And everybody turned up and did two numbers or something, which in itself is extraordinary.
Uh-huh.
They're all plugging into the same amplifiers. These, again, iconic Vox AC30s and AC50s with valves, of course, which had a great live sound, although they used to pack up more regularly than the new transistorised ones. Yeah, so, and that's 62, and then that's next to it, the year later, it's the Beatles again, but it's still with those, you know, iconic Vox AC30s and 50s.
Right, tell us about this intriguing picture of Dickie Valentine.
Yeah, well, I'm not an expert on Dickie Valentine, because it predates me, really. You know, this is sometime when I'm 5 or 6 when this picture is taken, and it says his fans included many women in their 20s and 30s, and What it does for me is epitomise a style of women's clothing that I remember very vividly from that period. It was just what you would see. Quite respectable in a way, you know, quite long skirts and long dresses. But there's a fair variety there, you know, because one thinks of it as an austere period. We're only just out of rationing. The hairstyles are all permed, aren't they, and sort of longish but swept back off the face, and it doesn't have any of that hint of what's coming in rock and roll and I don't know, the whole kind of bohemian thing that's around the corner. This is, Dickie Valentine is a showbiz crooner of the British variety and was huge. I mean, he really was huge for a brief period, and he's I can see one guy, I think. There's one guy at the back there, isn't there? Oh, there's a couple over there as well at the back.
There's some very restrained hand clapping as well, by the looks of it.
Yes, yes. There's one woman who looks like she's just about to jump up and get really excited. But I mean, the other thing I would love is a time machine to go back and hear what it really sounded like, because the equipment that they were using, the microphone and the PA system and so on, is so, by today's standards, so primitive. But you just wonder what it sounded like. Did it sound almost acoustic? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. And he's definitely mid-note there, isn't he?
Nearly
peaking in the song.
He's having a good time, yeah. But he was massive, just briefly. And that's very much the kind of... That's very much the British crooner pre-rock and roll, pre-beat group image. Yeah.
And next to it, there's a quite an intriguing picture again of Joe Brown, who seems to be doing a kind of... a Hendrix number before Hendrix did, perhaps.
Oh, well, I mean, we do, yeah, what he's doing is playing the guitar behind his head. I mean, to my knowledge, the first guy to do that was a blues guitarist called T-Bone Walker. And I think it's probably something that Brown has learned about, because 1962, T-Bone Walker wouldn't have been to Britain then. I think he came about 2 years later. But what's also interesting is that he's doing what people often did, which is, in those days, the solo acts would play with session musicians behind them.
Mm-hmm.
And there would be one session band on these big concerts, and they would be very accomplished, knowledgeable, but slightly world-weary, slightly cynical musicians, and they're not looking that impressed, are they?
The guy on the, I think it's the saxophone, is looking like he doesn't want to be there.
He really is, isn't he? Yeah, yeah. What's all this clowning going on? It's rather nice, because Joe Brown actually, we opened this show about 10 days ago, and on the same night, Joe Brown was playing at the King's Theatre.
Oh, right, yeah.
Which is, what, 47, 48 years later, so he's still going, and he's a good entertainer.
Now... you're a local boy made good, as they say.
Well.
You've tell us about the kind of the Pompey aspect in terms of the rock memorabilia and the local things that you're trying to work into the exhibition.
It's a long story in some ways. I mean, I'm a local musician who played a lot in the 60s and early 70s, and then went off to pursue this academic career, after which I remained semi pro like a lot of other guys, and enjoyed playing and had some happy times. Because I became at the university a sort of cultural historian, initially around things like art and film and so on, just for fun, about 12 years ago, I began to document the history of some of this period and published one or two things. Then the museum did a thing which was an oral history project with local musicians, and I was one of the people interviewed for that, and there were photographs in it. And it stimulated me to keep it going, really. So last year, I did a big presentation at the Theatre Royal, which was called Here Come the 60s. And in fact, I did start with Tony Crombie in 56, and it was entirely about the acts and the venues. And I tried to cover jazz and folk music and rhythm and blues, as well as rock and beat, you know, that whole thing. And I did a presentation at the Theatre Royal with a publication to accompany it. And the museum knew about that. So when this exhibition was offered them by the V&A, they said, well, we'd like to do a local aspect to it. Mm. And I guess at that point I was the obvious person to invite. And, of course, I do have this huge advantage, apart from personal knowledge, I've been a fan and a musician. There is this lovely reality about being a university lecturer, which is that this hobby and this passion suddenly becomes legitimate research, mm-hmm. and they allow you to do, well, what I'm doing today, being at the exhibition, talking to people, interviews with you, and that gets more response. So people phone up, people bring things in, they offer more things, mm-hmm. and it's very exciting, really. So I would like to see it as a project that goes on and on and on forever, actually. And while I'm not necessarily the man to be documenting the history of punk in Portsmouth and post-punk and so on, I think there are people who might. And I think it would be a really rather lovely project to share with younger people and get them in, rather than what I've had to do, which is to scramble around with people and say, have you got anything left from 40 years ago? Get them doing it while it's still fresh and documenting it in that way, I think would be a lovely, lovely thing, you know, a sort of legacy covering, you know, how Portsmouth has entertained itself over the decades, really.
Yeah. And how do you want local people to get involved in the exhibition? I mean, we saw, as we were coming up the stairs, we saw a gentleman coming in with a carrier bag full of vinyl and other trinkets.
He's amazing.
Is that
his name's Dave Barber, and
he's a big Helen Shapiro fan, and he just brings things for us, which is what a lot of people have done. A lot of people came to my thing at the Theatre Royal, and because I have links locally, I say to the guys that I used to play with, tell people this is happening, and they'll tell somebody else that I don't know, and somebody. So I came back from Brighton this morning, and on the way back, unfortunately I wasn't driving, but I got a phone call from somebody in a band called Pete Stroller and the Drifters, about whom I know a little bit but not much. Mm-hmm. And he was in the band, and he's got photographs, and he's going to email me some scanned stuff tonight. And so that's one way of doing it. I'm at the exhibition every Monday, as we are now, between 11 and 3, and I'm just wandering around talking to anybody, taking copies of things, making contacts with them. We have some Sunday afternoon events, and I think at 2 o'clock I'm inviting some local people to come along and talk about how they got started, and it's every month, but you can pick up flyers at the museum about it. Mm-hmm. And it's those ways, really, but certainly anybody can get a message to me at the museum anytime, and I'll respond, you know, and keep building up this archive.
It's great, and it's a really kind of interactive approach, isn't it, that you've taken?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it sounds a bit funny, really, because in a way, my role at the minute is to be considered the kind of local expert for this sort of stuff, and I suppose, you know, because of my job, I know a bit about collecting together cultural history and so on and so on. I don't want to become the expert in Portsmouth entertainment, because I think it's a bit like Portsmouth football, really. There's thousands and thousands of experts. Mm. There's lots and lots of stories. I just think it's useful to have somebody who can be the kind of focal point and get the stories told. But there's plenty of people out there who know, you know, particularly one of the things that fascinates me is about the dance bands into the jazz period. And I went and watched a lot of jazz in the 60s when I was young. I saw Duke Ellington and the Modern Jazz Quartet and people at the Guildhall. But I'm not the expert on that scene, and I'd love to meet people who used to go to the Cobden Arms or the original Rendezvous Club and tell me stories about what that was like, and, you know, love to hear those stories.
Okay, so what we are here is at one of the cabinets that we've organised about the local shows, and this is a cabinet which has got lots of links with Cliff, actually. So there's a three-piece vocal group called the Honeys, who toured Israel with Cliff Richard and also appeared with the Beatles and Helen Shapiro and all sorts of people. And the rather lovely story is that one of the Honeys lives still in Cosham, mm-hmm. and is married to a chap called Chris Harvey, who we can see down here in a kind of vocal group, almost like a barbershop quartet. But in 1959, he's playing locally in a group called the Live Five. Now, a lot of the time, there's only four of them, because one chap's in the RAF on national service, but they're called the Live Five, and they appear very, very briefly in the Cliff Richard film Espresso Bongo. They're only in the background, but they're there. And so Chris is married to one of the Honeys, have also toured with Cliff, and Chris has still got the shirt that he wore in Espresso Bongo and the guitar that he played in Espresso Bongo.
It's an amazing shirt, isn't it?
And it's just great, isn't it? He's given both of them to us. So we've got them on display with the Espresso Bongo EP.
Do you have a favourite photo from the exhibition, or favourite set? Or?
I have one or two for personal reasons. I like the Tony Crombie picture because of the link to the history of Portsmouth. There's a photograph of Harry's that we've imported, which is of the Beatles with Chris Montez and Tommy Rowe backstage. And it's not actually at Portsmouth, at least I don't believe it is. But it's the first time the Beatles came to Portsmouth and I was there. It was the first live gig I ever saw. So in a personal, you know, sometimes you can just connect in a personal sense and say, that's a really powerful image and I love it to death. I'm very fond of the image of Billie Holiday because I love Billie Holiday's music very much, you know. So there is that magical thing about the first gig I ever went to, and it happened to be the Beatles, and it was sheer luck.
That's a great, great memory. Okay, Dr. Dave Allen, thanks very much for your time. Thanks for talking to me. Thanks.
Thank you. Pleasure.
The Birth of British Rock and Roll exhibition is currently at the City Museum, Portsmouth until the 6th of June 2010. For more information, go to www.portsmouthmuseums.co.uk/exhibition, or you can telephone the museum on 023 9282 7261. The exhibition is open daily from 10 o'clock till 5 o'clock. Admission is free. That's it for this episode. Join me next time for more intriguing pebbles from the cultural coast. Sandy by the Sea is a King of the Buttons production for Express FM. My thanks to the City Museum and the University of Portsmouth for their cooperation in the making of this programme.